The Florida community of mindfulness is happy to make these talks available to you. If you find this talk to be a benefit, please consider making a donation to support us. You'll find a donation button on the talks section of our website, floridamindfulness.org. Thank you, and may you be happy and free of suffering.
Today we are acknowledging the birth of the Buddha. If you're wondering who this this child in front here, this is the Buddha when he was born. You know, most babies when they're born, they just kind of come out, well, as newborns, you know, not looking too good and certainly not standing up and pointing up and down and speaking some words. So this is a rather unusual young child. So I'll talk a little more about the Buddha's birth and the real meaning of that. But first I wanted to spend really a lot of the morning talking with you about something that's kind of unique, which is that in the Buddhist tradition, and when I say the Buddhist tradition, I mean there is certainly a body of teaching and philosophy and meditation and practice that is the essential path of Buddhism. But also, as Buddhism has been around for thousands of years and came out of culture and everything else, it certainly has a lot of tradition, go to the Buddhist tradition, which is which many of us are not familiar with. And part of the Buddhist tradition is this body of literature called the Jataka Tales. And the Jataka Tales purport to be the past lives of the Buddha. So we know very clearly that the Buddha was an historical person. We know where he was born. We know where he lived. We know where the major events of his life took place. That's all been very historically documented. But in the Buddhist tradition, it purports that his manifestation in this world, kind of manifesting over time as a fully enlightened being, didn't just come out of nowhere. And it didn't just come out of really just the efforts that he made in his own life. And those who are familiar with the story of the Buddha's life, we get a sense of his own disillusionment that precipitated his spiritual search, his own wandering about for 6 or 7 years, taking teachings, doing practices, and eventually coming to a way of coming to his own realization of the true nature of things, his own liberation from delusion, and his own awakening to his intrinsic wisdom mind that allowed him to, without ever reading a book, allowed him to manifest in such a wise way for nearly 50 years, helping so many people. So there is this tradition of Jataka tales. Again, if one has a as a sense that there is a continuity of consciousness over time, that even though the physical body clearly is born at a certain pace and dies at a certain place, that's very obvious in this world and everybody here, we do have our life, but that sort of the consciousness, the mind, which is not material and is a certain kind of energy, has a certain continuity. So whether you believe that or not really doesn't matter in this moment. Because the Jataka tales, as many tales, myths, stories, have meaning. And oftentimes, you know, when we hear a story, hear a parable, we kind of get a meaning at a kind of deeper level than we do if somebody just tells us the philosophical or ethical or moral principle, you know, the story. I mean, we are people who tell stories, right? We tell stories to each other. Most of us have turned our life into a story. You know, and it's a good story, it's a bad story, it's a valiant story, it's a, human beings, we take the material of life and turn into stories. So there are this whole body of literature called the Jataka Tales, which purport to be the many lives of the Buddha. And I think that's important, just that kind of fact, because, you know, like all of us are here right today. I don't know everyone here, I know many of you. We are here today, showing up today with our aspirations, with the way we want to live life, the way we conduct life, but we just didn't, you know, manifest today. You know, we all have a past, right? And in our past, we have done things, and we haven't done things. And a lot of who we are today and showing up today is because of our past, right? So we know that the past conditions the present. And that again, the way we are today is really the outcome of many past events. Is that clear? And we can also look at just this life and go, yeah, I mean, you know, we might sort of remember what we were like as a preschooler. We may remember what we like in elementary school. We remember what we were like in middle school and high school, our teen years, our young adult years, you know, depending. And these really almost can seem like very discrete events, right? You know, we may think back to the person we were when we were seven and really not, you know, it's just a story about when we were seven or growing up in our family. I mean, these are stories, right? And they are conditioned us to how we are today. So kind of understanding that we are not just, sprung, you know, every day we don't wake up fresh, you know, brand new. That would be nice. But we don't. We wake up often in terms of all the conditionings of our mind and body relationships, you know, that have brought us here. And so it is often helpful in the same way to understand that, that in this moment, in this life, with all the things we want to do, the things we want to change, the things we want to transform, that we are the product of our past, and that has to be dealt with, healed and transformed, as we say. That the Buddha, even though he manifested in this world as this enlightened being, also had his past. And to understand his past is to understand why he was capable in this lifetime to accomplish so much. Right, so we have kind of perspective, right? And that perspective helps us understand ourselves and understand other people, to understand this is a long-term process that we're involved in. For some of you, it's, this life has been a long-term process. But if you have a kind of sense of many lives, you know, endlessly unfolding, this energy that just keeps unfolding, it also gives perspective on this life for us. The other interesting thing beside that sense of past is that, and the stories I'll be reading today will give you a sense of it, that in many of these Jataka tales, the Buddha was an animal. And to me, that's very meaningful. And I think in a certain way, there was an understanding there about animals and other life forms having their own intelligence, having their own life, having their own relationships that are meaningful to them. As developed in these stories, and that there are many of the qualities that animals show are qualities that are human, that we know. So I think that sense of, that the animal realm, the fish realm, the bird realm, is not a dumb realm. Is not an insensitive realm. But it is a realm that has its own sentience, its own sense of feeling, its own sense of connections, is very important to us because we are interconnected. Right? And we are interconnected with all life. And so I think what the Jataka tales often bring out to me is that, life is very manifold in its unfolding. And that the evolution, it's interesting we talk about evolution. Some people don't believe in evolution. But the same way, there's talk about evolution kind of in a biological way, there's an evolution also in a kind of consciousness way. And I think the Jataka tales make us very aware of that and very sensitive to these other realms that we live with. And unfortunately, we've often seen that the animal, the fish, the bird realm are really either just here to serve us. They're here for us to eat. They're here to be eradicated at our will. So it's a very interesting way that we sort of view these other realms of life that we share the earth with. And I think that these Jataka tales, in choosing to see that the prior life of the Buddhas in prior life wasn't just a human being, he was also an animal. Okay, so I think, and again, there's great meaning in that. So before I talk about the birth of the Buddha, I want to read some stories. So everybody, please get into get in that mode, Like we often love listening to stories, don't we? As children, that was really one of our great pleasures. Being told stories by family members, parents, stories at school. Teachers would tell us stories. It's a very magical world, the world of stories. And so I want you to kind of enter that realm. Put aside your critical grown-up adult mind, just for a few minutes. You may decide you may not want to pick it up again. You might find that the mind of a child, the openness of a child, and the willingness to see the truths of stories and myths, may be a nice way of being. So I'm reading, I could actually be telling the story, but I'm kind of, just to keep me on track, I'm reading from the book The Hungry Tigress, Buddhist Legends and Jataka Tales, was told by Rafe Martin. Actually, Rafe is an old dear friend of mine, and sort of his love of the Jatakas kind of rubbed off on me. The Brave Little Parrot. Okay. So once upon a time, a long time ago, the Buddha was born as a parrot. And he lived in the forest. And one day there was a storm, a lightning storm, and a tree was struck by lightning, caught on fire, and soon there was a raging forest fire. The little parrot saw that and kind of flew around telling all the animals to flee to the river, where they could find safety. And many of them did flee and got to the river. And then as the little parrot was going back and forth, it saw that many of the animals, now the fire had kind of spread between the area that many of them were coming from and the river, and so many of the animals were trapped. or couldn't get through. And he came to the river where all the animals, the larger animals, were already taking refuge. He said, come, come, you know, our fellow brothers and sister animals are trapped. Come, come, you know, help me see what we can do to save them. And they said, no, 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 it's too dangerous. You know, we're quite, you know, we've made it to the river safely, and we want to stay safe. Why should we go back and endanger ourselves? So the little parrot was very distressed at that. You know, it's just a little parrot. And so it just could not bear the thought of leaving all those animals to burn. So it devised a plan. It would swoop just on top of the water, and it would get its wings all wet. And then it would quickly fly back to where the forest was burning and shake its wings to drop the droplets of water on the fire. And it thought in this way it could put it out. And so this parrot is going back and forth, back and forth, getting more and more exhausted, and obviously not really having any effect on the fire, right? Now, in those days, there were gods who lived up there. And the gods, you know, like gods, they spent their time enjoying themselves, you know. They would sit around and, you know, eat delicious foods, play beautiful music. You know, they had a godly existence. And then, you know, from time to time, they would look down on the earth and just to see what these human beings were up to. And usually they just laughed, you know. And that's what they were doing, actually, when they looked down and they saw this little parrot with this utterly futile, hopeless, you know what I mean? And they kind of laughed. Look at that ridiculous little parrot down there, you know, thinking he can put out a fire. She could put out a fire just by going by the wings. And they were laughing, laughing, laughing. Except for one of the gods was kind of moved by this, you know, futile effort to put out the fire all by itself. And so this god transformed himself, herself, into a great eagle, giant eagle, and flew down and came down and flew right beside the little parrot and said, little parrot, you know, I you know, you're a brave little parrot. It's wonderful what you're doing, but your effort is futile. You will never be able to put out this fire all by yourself. And little parrot kind of said, yes, I know, but I cannot not do it. You see, I cannot not try to help. And so the little parrot continued. And this great god, watching that, was so moved by this effort that was essentially futile, was so moved, began to cry. So touched was the god by what the little parrot was doing. Of course, the tears of a god are voluminous. And so the tears came down and came down and came down. And before very long, the fire had been put out. The little parrot was the hero, right? And it could also be why the, you know, the parrots have such beautiful feathers, you know, because kind of a reward. So that's the story of the little parrot. And of course, the Buddha in that prior lifetime was the little parrot. Right? Even as an animal, right? Even against all odds, was showing a desire and a connection with its fellow animals, right? And you know, you see that in birds, right? I mean, you often see, even around here, you don't even have to go to Great Woods, but you in the trees and in the parks, you see, you'll all of a sudden hear a lot of, noise going on, and you'll see that a bunch of little birds are driving away a hawk, right? Right, much, much bigger than that. Or little tiny birds are driving away blackbirds or ravens or other kinds of birds that would attack them or want to eat their young. So you see the idea of bravery, of a willingness to take on much bigger odds that are often futile, is not unknown in the animal kingdom. The connection of the parents to the children is definitely known in the animal kingdom. And the mother bird, the father bird, will, at the cost of their own life, do what they can to protect the life of their children. It's a very human, we call that what? A very human trait. You see, in our arrogance, we call it a very human trait. Right? We are quite astounded to see human traits in animals. Perhaps they're astounded when they see animal traits in us. You see, they might think that they had them first. You see, but we don't know. We can only infer. So that's one of the lives of the Buddha. Now, there's another life when the Buddha was. It's called the Banyan deer. So he was a. He was like the head of a herd. He was like the big stag, the head of the herd. And he lived in the forest with his herd and other herds. And the king of that principality, he loved to hunt. And he would go out, he and his hunters, with their bows and arrows and spears, and they would, hunt, and they would. And if you've ever been to India, they would have their beaters who would go ahead, often going through fields and everything, beating their drums and blowing horns. This is the way they used to do it in India, to drive the animals out, so the hunters could kill the animals. So, so this created a lot of not only, obviously. Pain and suffering for the animals, but the farmers were getting upset, okay, because the king and his hunters and the beaters were trampling through their crops, to drive a lot of the animals, were among their crops. So the villagers all got together, and they decided, to come up. They came up with a plan. And their plan was to build a big stockade and to drive a couple of herds of deer into the stockade, okay, which they did. And then they went to the king and they said, King, we know you love to hunt and we know you love to eat venison and all that. So what we've done is we've driven these herds of deer into a stockade. And so now all you need to do when you come out is go to the stockade and you can get up on top and you can, kill as many deer as you want. So the king, being somewhat wise or responsive to his people, agreed. Now, so the problem was that was fine from the human side. But what this meant is that the deer in the stockade lived in great fear and chaos, right? would there be these archers shooting down at them. So they got together. Actually, there were two herds and there were two kings, one of which was the Banyan king, the Buddha. So they got together and they came up with their plan, which was they understood that they were trapped, and they understood that the king had a need to kill them every day for food and also for the enjoyment of killing. So they decided they would have a lottery. And every day they would hold a lottery, and the deer that, this is not a good lottery. Basically one deer would be selected, and that deer would present itself to the hunter when they arrived in the morning. Okay. So in that way, rather than the chaos of the hunt and the fear of the hunt, one would be sacrificed every day. And when the hunters came the next day and they saw this one deer out and all the other deers hanging back and this one deer trembling, this was different. So they reported back to the king, and the king came out to take a look. And he was quite, he kind of understood what was happening, and he was quite moved by that. Right? By the intelligence of these animals and the willing of one animal to sacrifice themselves. So he said to his hunters, okay, from now on, every day, only kill one deer. Okay. Now, it so happened that one day in the lottery, and I'm not sure how they did it, but the one who was chosen or picked the wrong card or something was a pregnant deer, and she was full with baby. And she wasn't of the herd of the Banyan king, she was the other in the hilly herd, and she came to her king and said, please spare me, the king says only one killed every day, but I have one inside me, so it's two, right? So can you please spare me? She said to her king, please spare me, and can you pick somebody else? And he said no. He said, this is a fair lottery, and her special circumstances, he didn't have any meaning to him. So she went to the Banyan king, who was previous the Buddha. And she said the same story to him. And he listened to her. And he felt her sadness and her grief and her caring for this child within her. It wasn't for her, it was for the child. And so he said, okay, I will find somebody to stand in for you. And then he thought to himself, how can I ask somebody else to stand in for her? She was the one who was chosen. So therefore, only I can do that. Right? That morning when the hunter came, who did he see standing in front of the herd to be killed? Was the Banyan king. And because the Banyan king was such a magnificent animal, and he knew that the king kind of respected his intelligence, ran and got the king and said, King, you have to come and see what's going on. It's the Banyan king today who is to be killed. And so the king came. And when he saw the Banyan king, he asked him, in those days animals could speak and humans could understand their speech. And he asked him, what's he doing there? And the Banyan king told him the story, and he was so moved, because then he's a king too, you see. The king is a king, and he has his subjects. And he was so moved by the compassion and the intelligence of this other animal king that he said, all right. You know, from now on, your herd, you and your herd, will not be subject to any more killing. And the Banyan king, thank you, great king. But I have a request. And the king said, well, what's your request? He said, I have a request that you also spare the lives of all the other deer. The king was quite dumbstruck by that. That this king not only cared about his own subjects, but also cared about the other subjects. And so he reflected on it, was moved by the request, and said, okay, I grant from now on we will not hunt deers. And the Banyan king said, thank you very much, king. But I have one more request. You know, all the four-legged creatures in the forest live in fear of you and your hunters, and they also have their own lives, their own relationships. I ask that you not kill any more of the four-legged creatures. Again, the king was moved by that request, and he said, yes, I will do that. Then the Banyan king said, I have one more request. Or I have another request. And the king said, what is that? He said, you know, the birds, they also have their lives. Their freedom is important to them. Their life is important to them. Will you also spare their life, their lives of all the birds? King, you know, just kind of blown away by this, finally says, all right, I will. Thank you, King. You are a great ruler. And I only have one more request. You know the fish that live in the rivers and the lakes. They're also living beings, right? Who, when they are captured, when they are hooked and netted, they suffer. They suffer pain. Don't you see how they thrash about? They want to live. Please, would you spare them? And the king did. And so from then on in that kingdom, there was no more hunting or fishing or trapping of animals. So that was the story of the Banyan King. The last story I'm going to share with you is a briefer story. And this was, it's very interesting. Well, I'll tell you about it afterwards. So this is the story of the hungry tigress. And in this story, the Buddha was a young prince in Nepal. And he was out one day in the forest. Perhaps he was hunting. I'm not sure what. Well, maybe not hunting. I don't know what he was up to. But anyway, he was out in the forest. And all of a sudden, he saw in front of him, a little distance, laying on the ground, a tigress, a female tiger. And near her were a bunch of tiger cubs. But the tigress was emaciated. Right? She'd obviously had been sick and had not been able to hunt. Because she was sick and not able to hunt, her body had shrunken, and because her body had shrunken, she had no milk to give her cubs. And so they were looking like they were going to die too. And the young prince saw this kind of tragedy right there in front of him, and he realized that probably what the tigress would have to do to survive would be to eat her cubs. Just kind of struck by this terrible choice, you know, this Tigris had. He decided that he would offer himself to the Tigris to eat. So he went up to a little overhang or cliff above her, and he jumped off and fell right next to her. She ate him. She was nourished by eating him. She received milk again. She was able to move around, and she and her cubs lived. Right? Now, I say I have a personal connection to this story because if you go to Nepal today, about 30, 40 miles outside of Kathmandu, you've all heard of Kathmandu, is a place that is sacred to Buddhists and perhaps others too. And this place is the place where they say this event occurred. You go, well, how in the middle of Nepal, in this one place, is there a place that everybody agrees has happened? And I can't explain it. But yet, historically, people say that's where this event happened. That somehow this story was within the Nepali tradition of that this is where this happened. And when you go there, and I went there many years ago when I was in Nepal, when you go to that spot, there's like a frieze, which has a picture of the prince laying before the hungry tigress and the cubs, commemorating it. But even more interesting, above on the cliff, there is a tree. And when I saw this tree, the thing that strikes you is the tree is full of hair, human hair. And what that's about is when Buddhists go there, like on pilgrimage, to that site, acknowledging this path where one, I mean, the Buddha's, as the prince, you know, we might say he gave the ultimate sacrifice. Of course, we use those words. Even today, we say people are willing to give the ultimate sacrifice of their life to help others, to protect others, right? So it's not unknown. This kind of unknown. But so this what's called the bodhisattva path, where one puts the needs of others and the well-being of others and works for the benefit of others, often ahead of oneself. This story so epitomizes that what people do there is they cut some of their hair. It's kind of a symbolic gesture, right? Sort of saying, yeah, I'm willing to sacrifice a little of my what? Myself, my vanity, my whatever, kind of as an acknowledgement of this great effort that the Buddha made. And also to make the wish, coming to a place like that, which is very traditional when you're on pilgrimage and you go to these special places, you don't just go there to acknowledge them, but you go there to make the wish that oneself one day will accomplish the same thing. So when one goes to India and goes to the what's called Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha came to enlightenment, and you sit under the same tree the Buddha, well, it's not the same tree, but it's a child of the same tree that the Buddha sat under, one makes the wish, the aspiration that may I one day sit under the Bodhi tree. May I one day come to full enlightenment. May I one day be a light unto this world. In the same way one goes to any pilgrimage places. So in the same way, when one goes to this place that's called Namo Buddha outside of Kathmandu, people make this aspiration that they one day will have that kind of selflessness, that they can just, without thought, put the needs of others ahead of themselves. I mean, obviously, this is quite dramatic. Many of us may not be ready for that, right? Actually, I do want to talk about the Buddha's life, but it just reminded me, a little personal anecdote. Well, beside the last one, which was another personal anecdote. I've been in retreat all weekend with the transmission group, so my throat's a little raspy this morning. Interestingly enough, when I went to India in 1975, I don't know if it's still the case, but in those days, when you arrived in India because of international time changes and it was almost a 24-hour flight, you usually arrived in the middle of the night, you know, like 2, 3 in the morning. And so we had known about, turned out to be fairly sparse, this kind of guest house or something, where pilgrims from Ladakh, when they came down to New Delhi, stayed. So we had gone there. Of course, when you show up at a place like that at 3, 4 in the morning, there's nobody about, so we were just kind of there. So anyhow, when people started getting up in the morning, they discovered us and found us a place to stay. And then somebody, young Tibetan guy comes over and says, he starts talking to us, he speaks English. Can I ask us what we're doing here and tell him, you know, we're here to, you know, to learn about Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, meet teachers, etc. He says, oh, come, there's a great teacher staying here. So I won't go into the whole thing. So this was our first experience. So we're taken into this little room, this very bare room, and there's just a bed. And sitting on this bed is this Buddhist monk with a shaven head. And it's interesting. You notice on all Buddha statues, there's this little protuberance on top. It's like supposed to be one of the signs of the Buddha, right? You notice this little protuberance they have, sort of an extra little thing. And he had one. I mean, it could just be a deformation of his head, but he had like this little thing sticking up. I mean, and he was shaven. I mean, this was kind of the shape of his skull. And he also had like, it was kind of dark and there was one light on, but he sort of, his skin had a golden hue to it. It was very kind of striking. And this Tibetan guy spoke English. And so he translated for us. So this was our first encounter. And one of the interests, he sort of asked us why we're here and, you know, take teaching, go on pilgrimage to the places where the Buddha had lived and done this and that. And so he looked at me and said, you know, all those stories, the Jataka stories about the Buddha's past life and all the sacrifices he's made, you know, like the hungry tigress, or if somebody needed an eye, give him an eye, somebody, you know, take an arm. You know, he said, you have to understand, they're all true. Just looked straight at me. He said, they're all true. He said, an enlightened being can do that because they have no attachment to even their body. And then he said, but you don't do that. He said, you're not there yet. Right, so again, it's not like something you do by thinking about it, or something that, you know, this came naturally, you see. You want to get to the point where your selflessness and your concern for others is natural. It doesn't mean that short of these great sacrifices and acts of selflessness that we cannot become more selfless in our life and put others' needs ahead of ourselves in our life, right? And I'm sure you all do that. in many ways. In many of our ways in life, we do for others. We put others ahead of ourselves, our own needs and wants. And, you know, that's called love, right? And you can see in these stories that love extended beyond the immediacy, you know, in the parrot, in the banyan deer. His love was just not for himself. His love was just not for his herd. His love was not just for deer. His love was not just for all the other four-legged animals. You know what I mean? It was very wide and all encompassing. And that's certainly the path we want to practice. So, with all these endless lives of all, and again, if you read the Jataka tales, they all, you know, they're all different, you know, and so you get a, if you put them all together, you get a picture of this unfolding, this endless practice of selflessness, right, in so many guises, that is sort of the preparatory path that one day emerges, you know, into enlightenment, right? I mean, usually for many of us, we think of enlightenment and the real understanding as something that just comes out of meditation. But in Buddhism, we talk about the path of accumulation is the path of merit and the path of wisdom. Through meditation, through insight, through study, we gain intelligence about the nature of life, about the way things really are. And so we can act skillfully and wisely in this world because we accumulate wisdom. But we also have to accumulate merit. And merit means we accumulate merit through these selfless, compassionate actions, these virtuous actions that build up another whole capacity within us, right, to kind of balance the wisdom with compassion, right? So in Buddhism, we call these are the two wings of practice. And one without the other creates a kind of a lopsidedness in our development. It's, you know, because if you're just very wise, but you have no compassion for the suffering of beings, your wisdom can often go into a sort of an indifference toward people. On the other hand, if you're too far over here and you're just kind of, you know, a bleeding heart and there's no, you know, wisdom, you can just endlessly kind of be in your own exaggerated state of suffering. But if there's no understanding, your capacity to really help and benefit people is very limited. Is that clear? So you want to develop both. And so that's why in this practice we work both on the wisdom, on the compassion, on the mind, and the mind cultivation through mindfulness and samadhi, insight, and insight. But also we work on selfless service and compassion and loving kindness and developing. Okay? So, which brings me, and the kids are here today, and we're 11:55. Oh, good. So we have time. I'll take another sip of tea then. So like other religions, you know, in our culture, primarily a Christian religion, we celebrate the birth of Jesus. It's a celebration, right? In the same way, traditionally, Buddhists have celebrated the birth of the Buddha. So again, I wanted to talk a little bit about the background. So we don't somehow think that someone like a Buddha, a fully enlightened being, comes out of nowhere, or, you know, just comes out of 6 years of practice. Many of you, you know, that's what, from the time the Buddha left his family at the age of 29 till he came to full enlightenment at 36, 6 years transpired. There may be here people here who have practiced for 6 years, or 12 years, or 24 years, and wonder, how come I'm not a fully enlightened Buddha yet, and somehow think, you know, there must be something wrong with me. Well, you can see. You know, there may be something wrong with you. I'm not, and how we practice. So I'm not saying that, but we want to understand that, you know, when you see a fully awakened being manifest, this is in Buddhism. There is a you know, it's sort of like the iceberg, you know, or what's it, you know, where you only see the tip or something, you know, 10% of it or something, you know, the other is underneath. It's not seen. In the same way, you know, we see this manifestation, right? But we need to realize there is much preparation. So we might even say, like in these days, we see these great beings in our own time, and unfortunately, as you know, there are not that many of them around, but someone like the Dalai Lama, right? Or somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh. And of course, there are, you know, people in other traditions, and even non-religious traditions. You know, in our own world, you know, someone like Martin Luther King or people like that, you go, you know, where do these people come from, right? Because you look into their background and you go, well, you know, they seem to have a kind of a normal family, or they grew up in a, you know, a church family. You know what I'm saying? But many people do. It doesn't really get at where do they come from that they have such power? You know, because it's not as if Martin Luther King and Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh aren't saying things that many others aren't saying, are they? But there's a power, you see, and a development that is palpable, right? Why all of a sudden everybody listens to them, or many people listen to them. Is that clear? And one way to understand it is this idea, you know, that there is a lot behind them that is not seen, that is supporting how they're showing up today, right? And many of you may have that whole sense in your own life and with other people you know, that somehow there's something else going on here. And it's not just related to the outward circumstances of life. So, I mean, there's another interesting thing about the birth of the Buddha. You know, in India in those days, as I think still to today, it's very common, there's a lot of belief in astrology. And so it's very common when you're to do the, you know, that when the mother conceives, that they do the chart, you know, of the child to be born. And so when they called the astrologer and they did the chart for the Buddha's mother, it basically said two things about this child. This child will be a great being. If he goes a worldly path, he will be a great leader, you know, in the secular world. Right? But if he renounces the worldly life, he will be a great spiritual light. He will be a Buddha. Right? Now, which one do you think his parents wanted? Parents being parents, right? Because, I mean, the way it was put is, you know, he will be a renunciate, right? He will, because, you know, often they say the Buddha was born to this, you know, his father was a king and his mother was a queen. That's a little exaggerated. you know, these were like little principalities in northern India. So his father, you know, they were the nobility of that little kingdom, but this was not like great power, okay? So, but obviously they wanted their son, right, to what? To follow in their footsteps, right? So, they were very kind of disturbed by this prophecy and did not want their child to follow kind of a more spiritual path in life. They very much wanted him to follow a worldly path in life. And I think it's interesting that this was kind of laid out, because I think that's a challenge we all have. Right? You know, I think that's a very, you know, I mean, most of us don't have the choice between a world leader and a fully enlightened Buddha. I mean, that's not, that's a little grandiose for most of us. We're not there yet. But I think in our own way, many of us kind of, you know, have that choice, even on a very small scale, you know. In what way am I going to develop myself in this world? In what way am I going to use my gifts in this world, my energy in this world? Am I going to use it to achieve worldly goals? Worldly power, worldly success, worldly achievement? Or am I going to use it for what one might call more spiritual development? Right? How do I want to lead people? Right? Do I want to be a worldly leader? Right? Moving people toward worldly change? Or do I want to be a spiritual leader, a spiritual life, helping people in their own healing and transformation of themselves in the world, right? They're kind of not necessarily different, but they're just different ways of looking at that. And it's just again very interesting that these two paths were delineated for the Buddha. So according to these, to the traditional tales of the Buddha's birth, he came out small, but fully developed, and quite able to stand, and he took seven steps immediately and made a very strong declaration that he was going to be a Buddha, right? And he pointed up to the heavens and down to the earth, signifying that he is kind of one with everything, above the heavens, below the heavens. I am one. So a very strong declaration, which I think at those times, his mother and those people who were around at that time very quickly wanted to forget. and they sort of imply, I mean, it's just interesting, the story. And I think that's kind of interesting, because I think when a child is born into this world, and we were all infants born into this world, in a certain sense, the mind is very pure. The mind is totally unconditioned, right? Which means, depending on how things turn out, depending on what happens, depending on the causes and conditions, the environment in which we are born and subjected to, it could go in any direction, couldn't it? And we know for many, 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 many people, it goes in all kinds of directions, this life. Right? And oftentimes that essential unconditioned purity that is present in the mind at birth and that potentiality is forgotten, right? And so therefore, that's sort of what happened to Siddhartha, you know, whatever his initial purity and statement was at birth, nobody ever talked about. But if anything, his family did their best to support his moving in the direction that they wanted him to move into. So they, as you know, they kept him very protective, right? Totally tried to keep him away from any kind of situations in life that could any way kind of challenge him or wake him up or any way kind of move him to any kind of spiritual insight or renunciation. They really just filled his life with pleasure and support and achievements and all that. But that's another story. But so this is the Buddha. Again, as people who practice this way, I mean, we here follow the community of mindfulness, we practice mindfulness, we practice meditation, we practice insight, we practice all these various things that you know who come, that we practice that why? Well, because we are the heirs to this path of practice. This path of wisdom and understanding and compassion, you know, this path of meditation and awakening, right? I mean, it didn't just manifest out of nowhere, did it? You know, we are here because of our teachers. Our teachers are here because of their teachers. Their teachers are here because of their teachers. Their teachers were there because of their teachers and their teachers and their teachers, generation after generation after generation, going back to one person. It's quite interesting when you look at it that way, that this whole 2,600-year tradition of Buddhism and all the hundreds and millions or how many people have been involved in it at all different levels of practice and realization, it all began with one man, right? I mean, and that one man, it's because of his own practice, his own life, his own awakening that was transmitted to his students, to their students, to their students, you know, to us. So from that point of view of kind of history of the tradition, you know, if the tradition and the practice of healing and transformation and awakening is meaningful to someone, then you know, to pay honor and respect to the original founder, can you see, you know, has meaning. So that is why traditionally, you know, the life of the Buddha, like the life of Christ, like the life of Muhammad, like other, is meaningful to people who practice in that tradition. So, you know, in Asian Buddhist cultures, this is often fairly elaborated. the celebration, we're a little toned down, but we did want to take some time today to acknowledge the birth of the Buddha. Traditionally, people bathe the Buddha. So the Buddha is standing above. Is it tea? It's water. So, but fresh water, pure water. Because, you know, it's really two reasons. One thing is, what do you do with babies? You bathe them. You wash them. But also, it was considered meritorious to bathe a sacred object. So, traditionally, we come and we acknowledge the Buddha's birth, and we pour water over him as our way of offering purity, the purity of our intention, the purity of our heart, the purity of our aspiration to the Buddha, and we make the aspiration just like Shakyamuni Buddha, originally Siddhartha, may I one day become, you know, enter a world where there is much suffering and much ignorance. May I one day enter a world with the capacity to become an awakened one and to truly be able to give real benefit to other beings who are suffering. Basically, to show them the way how to have a meaningful and happy and suffering-free life, you see. So that's the aspiration that we make, that we acknowledge that each of us have in us a baby Buddha, right? A baby Buddha that wants, waiting to be born, waiting to be watered, right? And if we water the baby Buddha within us, that baby Buddha will grow, right? So please think about that.